radiofonica.
La migliore musica italiana in esclusiva.
Gli artisti emergenti più interessanti.
I live più adrenalinici.
La black music di Piotta.
Il music book di Dario Salvatori.
La musica al femminile di Note Rosa.
Videogames, animazione, cultura moderna.
Tutto questo e molto altro è Ubix, il miglior free press di musica e cultura in circolazione. Da gennaio Ubix arriva in Umbria. Cercalo ogni mese sul web e nelle migliori location della regione.
www.ubixweb.com.
Ubix.
Free press, free spirit, free music.
Welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke. Today on the show, we are going to be looking at the recent events in Japan, from the earthquake and ensuing tsunami to the threat of nuclear disaster. What has happened since the earthquake struck? What's the current situation? And what still needs to be resolved in the weeks and months to come? Plus, we'll be hearing from you at home. This is Short Science. So hello and welcome to the show. Now, today's show is dedicated to unravelling the recent events in Japan and finding out what the current situation is there. Now, it can be very hard to understand what's really happened in another country, especially one so far away. We see distressing pictures on the news, read conflicting reports in the newspapers, and without knowing what the real facts of a situation are, it can all be a bit overwhelming and can sometimes leave us feeling a bit manipulated by the media. Well, today we're going to cut straight to the facts and find out what has been happening since the earthquake struck and what still needs to be done to help the survivors rebuild their lives. And of course, we'll be sending them our thoughts and very best wishes. Now, last week on the show, we were talking about batteries, from the tiniest of batteries in a wristwatch to the familiar AA and even onto car batteries and emergency batteries in hospitals and industrial plants. Now, it was a great show, so if you missed out, don't forget that you can listen again at any time via our website, shortscience.co.uk, or by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Short Science and you'll see our logo there with all of our podcasts. Now, the website is also a good place to find out what's coming up in the next show and how you can get involved and get your voice heard on air. So, talking about next week's show, well, actually, it's the next couple of weeks. We're going to be having a two-part special on energy production. So, next week, we're going to be looking at the more traditional sources of energy, coal, gas, oil, and nuclear power. Then the following week, we'll be finding out about the latest renewable and alternative sources of energy, such as wind, solar, and even sewage power. Now, we would really love to hear from you and get your voice out on the Short Science airwaves. So if you have anything to say about old school or renewable energy sources, then please get in touch. So do you think that polluting coal power stations should be shut down? Should we go all out for nuclear power, or is that something to be avoided given the recent events in Japan? Should we be putting all of our faith in renewable sources? Is the technology sufficiently developed to allow renewable sources of energy to take over power production in the marketplace? Well, call in with your thoughts to +447401 856 681. That's 07401 856 681. All you need to do is wait for the beep, and then you'll get 2 minutes recording time to speak your mind. And if you run out of time, just redial and then we'll join the ends together and no one will ever know. Now, alternatively, you can send in any material or thoughts via email using our address here in the studio, studio@shortscience.co.uk. So next week is also a very exciting week for Short Science, as we will officially be joining Bungalow Radio, which launches on Monday. Now, we will be on the Bungalow airwaves every Wednesday at 8 p.m. and repeated at the weekends. Now, Bungalow also has some other great shows, so regular listeners to Short Science will know Ed Prosser and his Sounds of Science series. Well, that will be broadcasting on Bungalow in an extended format, so even more glorious sound jammed into each programme. There's an arts review programme hosted by Steve McGann and Corinne Pickamar, a music show presented by Dr. Martin Ostwick, and two sets of shows for children. Plus, they've got a show coming all the way across the pond from the United States, hosted by PQ Ribber, a kind of cultural pop music and arts show. And that's not the least of it. Bungalow is a community station that will play out programmes produced by anyone that wants to take part. So if you've got a great idea for a radio show and you own a computer or even just a tape recorder, you could be making your own show and sending it along to Bungalow for broadcast. Now, you don't need to have any experience. You can be any age, speak any language, and be based in any part of any country. The only rule is that you must not include any copyrighted material in your show. So that means absolutely no commercial music. Otherwise, your show cannot be broadcast. And speaking of music, if you're a budding musician and you're not signed to a record label, you can submit your own original music to the Bungalow playlist to hear your sounds live on air. So for both music and shows, check out the Get On Air link on the Bungalow website, which is bungalowradio.com. So let's get back to today's show now. Let's get cracking with the short science news in brief. Hillfort Communications put to the test. Volunteers in Wales have been testing the age-old theory that during the Iron Age, hilltop communities communicated with each other via torches at night. Volunteers stood on four hilltop fort sites and communicated over distances as far as 25 kilometres with flashing torches. Now, previous experiments of this sort had used large beacon fires, but this time simple high-powered torches were used. Advanced diabetes test. Experts have demonstrated that they can accurately predict which individuals will go on to develop type 2 diabetes within 10 years using a simple blood test. The scientists looked at five amino acids in the blood to make their predictions. The group at Harvard University believe that this could be a massive breakthrough in the management of diabetes, as early detection can help prevent the devastating complications such as kidney failure, blindness, and amputations. This test could identify people at risk of diabetes who as yet have no symptoms or other abnormalities detectable with routine blood tests. Taking lifestyle measures such as losing weight at this point could even prevent them from developing diabetes. MESSENGER enters Mercury orbit. The MESSENGER probe launched by NASA has become the first spacecraft to enter into orbit around Mercury. As MESSENGER was approaching the planet, it had to blast its main thrusters to slow its approach and allow capture by the planet's gravity. Now, due to the intense heat from the sun, MESSENGER has to be heavily shielded from the glare. And even just the reflected heat from the surface of Mercury could cause serious damage to the instruments on board the spacecraft. MESSENGER is now 96 million miles from Earth, but a mere 29 million miles from the Sun. Brain protein linked to autism. Scientists have identified a single protein in the brain that may be linked to autism spectrum disorders, causing a breakdown in normal communications between brain cells. The team from Duke University in North Carolina created a genetic mutation in mice which caused this protein called SHANK3 to be formed. As the mice grew up, they showed autistic-type behaviour. Now, many genes have previously been linked to autism, but it's unclear how the precise combination of genetics, biochemistry and environmental factors interact to produce the condition. Giant algae bloom found. An algal bloom that is about 50 miles long has been found off the coast of Cornwall and Devon. The bloom is formed from Skeletonema, which has risen to the surface in the warm weather. The bloom was spotted on satellite images of the area. The algae is not thought to be harmful. Now, blooms are common in springtime as nutrients build up in the waters during the cold winter months, but this bloom has occurred much earlier than usual. It's thought that recent windy conditions stirred up the waters, helping to bring the algae to the surface, where they've flourished. Brain drug delivery breakthrough. Scientists at the University of Oxford have developed a new way of delivering drugs to the brain. They have used the body's own transport mechanisms, called exosomes, to deliver drugs into the brain. Now, the brain is highly protected from our general circulation, and there is a physical barrier preventing substances from crossing from the blood circulation into the brain, the so-called blood-brain barrier. Now, this has made it difficult to deliver drugs directly into the brain. Scientists were able to use the exosomes, which actively transport substances into the brain, to deliver drugs that could be helpful in conditions like Alzheimer's disease. Solar panel funding cut. The UK government has slashed solar panel subsidies by up to 70%. The scheme has only been running for a year and investors have warned that this funding cut will seriously deter further renewable energy investment. The scheme was not due for review until 2013, and many investors had started projects that now will not be able to continue. The cuts especially affect larger installations, such as might be installed on a farm. Now, the government claims that this cut will protect funding for smaller-scale, individual rooftop panels. And finally today, tuberculosis vaccine draws closer. Scientists have identified a protein which could be targeted in a tuberculosis or TB vaccine. We already have the BCG vaccination, but this is not very effective, and many vaccinated individuals still contract the disease, which kills around 2 million people around the world each year. The researchers at Imperial College London claim that using this protein might trigger an immune response that would provide long-term effective protection from the disease. The protein, called ESPC, is secreted by the bacteria and is a potent stimulant of the immune system. Well, that's it for our science news today. Now, if you've got any comments or questions about any of our stories, give us a call on 07401 856 681 or drop us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's time now for our first capsule of the day. So let's start by looking at the disastrous events that have created such destruction in Japan. So when and where did the earthquake occur? Well, on Friday the 11th of March at 2:46 p.m. local time in Japan, a massive earthquake struck in the Tohoku region. Now, this was a magnitude 9 megathrust earthquake. The epicenter was 130 kilometers off the east coast of Japan near Sendai. The hypocenter of the earthquake was at a depth of 32 kilometers, and the actual quake itself lasted 6 minutes. So was this just one big earthquake? Well, the main earthquake was preceded by four shocks as powerful as 7.2 on the moment magnitude scale. There were over 600 aftershocks with a magnitude greater than 4.5 and as high as 7.4. So was there any warning that a big quake was on the way? Well, Japan has an earthquake early warning system which is made up of over 1,000 seismometers, which did issue a warning to millions of Japanese people, which probably saved many lives. Now, did the earthquake occur on a fault line? Well, the earthquake occurred where the Pacific plate is subducting under another oceanic plate, and there's a bit of scientific argument about which plates exactly were involved, but it definitely involved the Pacific plate. Now, the Pacific plate moves at a rate of about 8 centimetres per year, and as this plate is pulled underneath the other ocean plates, stress energy builds up and eventually causes a seismic event or earthquake. So in this case, a massive split occurred in the sea floor, which was many tens of kilometres long and only 32 kilometres deep. Now, the deeper an earthquake occurs, the less the effects are felt on the surface. So the shallow depth of this seismic event helps explain the strength of the shock. So this break in the plates caused the seafloor to suddenly spring up several metres, causing the earthquake. It's very unusual for such a dramatic event to occur where the plate boundaries are so convoluted. Usually the most powerful earthquakes occur where the plate edges are very straight, and often hundreds of kilometres of plate edge will be involved. And in this case, there was a relatively small area involved. So how much energy was released by the earthquake? Well, this earthquake released a surface energy of around 2 times 10 to the 17 joules, which was dissipated into the environment as shaking and tsunamic energy. Now, just to give you an idea of how much that is, this was nearly double the energy release in the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. If the energy could have been captured and harnessed, it could have powered a city the size of Los Angeles for over a year. Now, the total energy released was more than 200,000 times the surface energy. And although the surface energy was more than the 2004 quake, the total energy released was actually slightly less, about equivalent to 9.32 teratons of TNT. So how has the earthquake changed the structure of the Earth? Well, the quake has moved some portions of northeastern Japan about 2.4 metres closer to North America, widening the landmass of Japan itself. Now, the biggest shifts were in the areas closest to the epicentre. It's thought that the Pacific Plate may have moved about 20 metres westwards, although some estimates put this closer to 40 metres. And if this were the case, it would be the largest recorded fault movement associated with an earthquake. But has the earthquake had an impact on the Earth as a whole? Well, according to Italy's Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, the earthquake has shifted the Earth's axis by about 25 centimetres. Now, the speed of the Earth's rotation also increased, which led to a shortening of each day by about 1.8 microseconds. Now, this has all happened due to the redistribution of mass on the Earth's surface, and that changed the planet's moment of inertia. Now, these changes are completely expected in this type of event and are nothing to worry about. So what about the tsunami that followed the earthquake? Well, there was a massive tsunami that caused terrible destruction along the Pacific coastline of Japan. The tsunami propagated across the Pacific, and places as far away as Chile felt the impact of the tsunami with waves that were about 2 metres high. Now, in Japan, though, the waves were as high as 10 metres and hit land as soon as 10 to 30 minutes following the earthquake. Just over an hour after the earthquake, the tsunami reached Sendai Airport. Now, the damage caused by the tsunami was actually far more devastating than the earthquake itself, with whole villages being swept away by the water. So how many people lost their lives in this terrible disaster? Well, the human impact reaches much further than simple numbers, but it's estimated that as many as 18,000 people have lost their lives, although there are countless more unaccounted for, and there are still devastating consequences from the earthquake and tsunami that are further threatening lives and health in Japan. Well, let's leave things there for the moment. That was a quick run-through of the main events that occurred in Japan a couple of weeks ago. Let's move on now to consider the ongoing impact with the nuclear threat of the Fukushima plant. So the news has been full of the dreadful threat of a full-scale nuclear meltdown at Fukushima. In fact, there's been a lot of talk about the events at Chernobyl many years ago. So what exactly has happened at Fukushima? Well, shortly following the earthquake and tsunami, it was revealed that the cooling systems in the reactors of Fukushima 1 had failed. Now, in response to this, a 2-kilometre exclusion zone was established and inhabitants evacuated. The following day, there was evidence of a partial meltdown of the fuel rods, and there was a hydrogen explosion which destroyed part of the roof of the reactor building. Now, the explosion itself injured 4 workers, but the reactor containment remained intact, meaning that the radiation and the radioactive material was still safely inside the reactor. Now, hydrogen and steam were being vented from the reactor to reduce pressure inside the containment vessel. Seawater was then brought in for emergency cooling. Now, this type of emergency cooling would cause permanent damage to the reactor, and so was not undertaken lightly. The evacuation zone was extended to 20 kilometres, meaning that around 200,000 people had to be rehoused. There was some emission of radioactive iodine from the reactor core, and Japanese officials began distributing prophylactic iodine tablets to those living around the site. And 1 worker was taken unwell at that point. Then, on the 14th of March, there was another explosion, this time at the reactor building for Unit 3 of the plant. 11 people were injured, but no further radioactive material was leaked. The following day, there were problems growing in the second reactor, which had been affected by the previous explosion in Reactor 3. So now Reactor 2 was posing the biggest threat, with damage to its containment system following an explosion in its pressure suppression room. Then a fire broke out in Unit 4 involving spent fuel rods. Radiation levels at the plant soared, but subsequently dropped back down. So on the 16th of March, radiation levels were announced to be rising steeply. Many employees were withdrawn from the plant, and more emergency cooling in reactors 5 and 6 this time commenced with seawater. On 18th of March, there was a really high radiation level detected in an area 30 kilometres northwest of Fukushima, and work was still ongoing to cool the reactors and also the spent fuel rods. So currently, work is ongoing to restore the power supply to the plant and keep up the cooling of the reactors. But there is still high pressure in the third reactor, and smoke has been seen issuing from the plant, but it's really unclear whether this is venting from inside the reactors and therefore might contain radioactive particles, or whether this is just steam or smoke from other areas. So what caused these dangerous conditions to occur at the plant? Well, when the earthquake was detected, the reactors underwent automatic shutdown, according to normal protocol, so everything went as planned. Reactors 4, 5 and 6 were actually already shut down for a routine inspection anyway. Now, when the reactors shut down, that means that electricity generation at the plant stops, and normally a backup electricity system would take over the supply of electricity, which would enable normal cooling to continue and also would power the control systems. However, on this occasion, the earthquake had damaged the power grid, meaning that there was no power to supply the cooling systems. Emergency generators operated briefly, but then failed. Now, the plant was surrounded by a seawall designed to protect the plant from tsunamis. The wall was 5.7 metres tall, but unfortunately, the tsunami wave was well over 10 metres tall, and this caused flooding of the generator building, which stopped the emergency power generation. So in situations where the external power grid fails and the emergency generators fail, there are batteries that will give about 8 hours power to the plant. However, due to the flooding, there was difficulty connecting the batteries and the replacements sent from other plants. So all the main problems at the plant stemmed from a power failure. Without power, the cooling systems could not operate, leading to increased pressure in the reactor cores and also exposure of the spent fuel rods. Now, all attempts to restore power have met extreme difficulty. The emergency generators were flooded, the batteries could not be effectively connected due to the flooding, there were mobile power units sent to the plant, but they couldn't produce enough power to get the reactor pumps operating again, and each explosion within the plant has caused more damage to various operations, making it even harder to salvage the situation. So hope is now resting on restoring the power grid. However, the cooling systems themselves have now been damaged by the emergency use of seawater to cool the reactors, so it won't be as simple as just switching them back on. So what will happen if the cooling systems cannot be salvaged? Well, there are several strategies in play to contain and help reduce the potential for radiation leak. Boron has been flown in from France. Now, this can be dropped in with the spent fuel rods, and the boron will actually absorb neutrons. Liquid metal can also be used to cool the reactor rods and delay the radioactive decay and release of radiation. And finally, once the heat has been dealt with and the material in the plant is essentially stable, albeit radioactive, the entire plant can then be shrouded in sand and clay to create a sarcophagus which will contain the radioactivity. So those were the events that have left the Fukushima nuclear plant stricken. Let's move on now to consider the wider effects on human health from this radiation leak and potential further leakage. Now, obviously, once radiation is released into the air, it is subject to atmospheric conditions, specifically the weather. Now, due to an anticyclone south of Japan, westerly winds were dominant during the week following the disaster. This meant that a lot of radioactive material was deposited out at sea. However, it also meant that some radioactive material was deposited over Tokyo. It was predicted that some radioactivity would reach the United States this week, but it should be very diluted and not a threat to health there at all. So what are the effects on health? Well, the levels of radiation that are present within zones where Japanese residents have been warned to stay indoors but not evacuated are actually significant. Now, the levels are said to be around 0.17 millisieverts per hour. So exposure to this level of radiation for about 6 hours would result in a person absorbing the maximum amount of radiation considered safe for 1 year. As a comparison, it's about the same amount as a chest X-ray. Now, for nuclear workers, the normal limits are 20 millisieverts per year. For emergency workers, the limit is 100 millisieverts. Generally speaking, though, an acute exposure to radiation is much more harmful than exposure to the same amount spread over a longer time. Now, a single exposure to 250 millisieverts is enough to increase the lifetime risk of developing a fatal cancer by about 20%. Chronic exposure to doses of 100 millisieverts also carries a cancer risk. But these are future risks of cancer from radiation exposure. What about radiation poisoning? Well, that requires a much higher dose, typically around 1,000 millisieverts is needed to cause radiation poisoning. So how much radiation is there at the reactor site? Well, there have been reports of readings as high as 1,000 millisieverts, but generally speaking, most readings seem to be coming in at around 600 to 800 millisieverts. Now, is radiation all the same Or are some kinds more dangerous to health than others? Well, different radionuclides can be formed, and these can have different effects on health. Now, radioactive isotopes of iodine have been found in Japan, and these are easily absorbed by the thyroid gland in the neck. Now, the radioactive iodine is held in the thyroid gland, and although it only has a half-life of 8 days, it increases the risk of future thyroid disease and thyroid cancer. Now, children are especially vulnerable to this effect. However, taking potassium iodine tablets such as have been distributed by the Japanese officials can actually prevent the absorption of the harmful radioiodine. Although tablets have been distributed in Japan, there have been reports of insufficient supplies, but generally speaking, the Japanese diet is high in natural iodine, which should help to protect people. Cesium-137 has also been found. Now, cesium-137 behaves a bit like potassium in the body and is therefore taken up by all cells throughout the entire body, and that can cause really widespread effects, most notably radiation sickness and also future risk of cancer. Now, it can be flushed out of the body using a substance called Prussian blue. Another isotope that's been found is strontium-90, and that behaves a bit like calcium in the body, and so gets taken up into bones and bone marrow. Now, this can have very serious effects on blood cell production, causing leukemia, and can also cause bone cancer. Now, the latest news from Japan is that levels of these isotopes aren't high enough in general to cause danger to health. However, it's a changing situation, and Japanese residents should stay aware of the news and of what's going on and follow the advice of local officials. Well, we're going to finish the show today by trying to answer some listener questions about these events.
You've got mail.
So first off, we have a question from Jeremy in Hampshire. Now, he has asked about the magnitude of the earthquake, and he says, I keep hearing on the news that a magnitude 9 earthquake is 60 times worse than a magnitude 8 earthquake. How can that be? Well, the answer to this is to do with the way that earthquake magnitude is measured. Now, you might imagine that a magnitude 4 earthquake would be 4 times worse than a magnitude 1, and magnitude 9 would be 9 times worse than magnitude 1. But the scale that's used to quantify the magnitude of earthquakes isn't a linear scale. It's called a logarithmic scale. And this means that as the numbers in the scale get higher, the difference between the numbers also increases. So the difference between 8 and 9 is far greater than the difference between 7 and 8. And in terms of earthquake magnitude, each step on the scale corresponds to 32 times the energy release of the previous step. So a magnitude 9 earthquake would be releasing 32 times as much energy as a magnitude 8 earthquake. And this leads us on quite nicely to the next question, which was actually asked by several people. So Anna in Bath, David in Lancaster, and Tracy in Haywards Heath all asked about the scale used to measure earthquakes. Now, we're all taught about the Richter scale at school, but no one has mentioned this on the news. So is the Richter scale still used, or is it called something else now? Well, the answer to this is that the Richter scale was developed in 1935 by Charles Richter and Benno Gutenberg. The actual name of their scale was the local magnitude scale, but it became known commonly as the Richter scale. Now, it was best at rating earthquakes with magnitudes between 3 and 7, pretty rubbish below 3 and above 7. And it was based on the motion detected by a particular type of seismometer at a distance of 100 kilometres from the epicentre of the earthquake. So now a scale called the moment magnitude is used. Now, it works, again, with a logarithmic scale in much the same way, but is better at measuring earthquakes at either end of the scale. Now, it was developed by Thomas Hanks and Hiri Kanemori in 1979. So, Janet in Doncaster has asked, when was the last earthquake in Japan? Well, Japan has a lot of earthquakes. In fact, there are usually several major quakes per year. Prior to March the 11th, the foreshock was actually a pretty major earthquake. This was on the 9th of March and measured 7.2 on the moment magnitude scale. Now, there were two earthquakes over magnitude 7 in 2010 and magnitude 6 quakes in 2009. Well, we're going to have to leave your questions there for the time being. That's about all we've got time for today. Now, you may remember that we were also going to talk about the beneficial effects of radiation and medical applications of nuclear technology. Well, we just didn't have time in today's show, so we'll be coming back to this topic in a few weeks' time. Now, everyone here in the Short Science Studio sends their best wishes to all those in Japan and beyond who've been affected by these terrible events. If you have any questions about anything we've been discussing in the show today, or would like to send in your comments or thoughts, then please leave a message on our recording machine at 07401 856 681 or email us studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now don't forget to get in touch with your thoughts about power generation for the next two shows, both traditional types of power station, coal and nuclear power, and also alternative energy sources. The number again is 07401 856 681 and the email studio@shortscience.co.uk. Don't forget to check out our website for details of every show, including what's coming up next week. You can find out how to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen online to any episode you like. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. My name is Elizabeth Hawke and I was your presenter and producer today. The theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. So thanks very much for listening and join us again next week for another episode of Short Science.
Corsi e ricorsi persi nella sempre, sotto un cielo nero e rame, fatto di rimpianti che ora non mi sfiorano. Ed è il tempo di riscoprire quel che è vita, dimenticando tutto quel che resta. Non puoi cancellare.
We'll be right back. paesi abbandonati non vogliono morire, accolgono le vite che sanno cosa dire, e terre saccheggiate raccolgono i destini di storie fatte a pezzi di eroi clandestini. Dormono le case cullate da cicale, all'ombra delle rocce riflesse dentro il mare, e pietre colorate di ore di marrone resistono al fuoco e alla maledizione. Di qua e di là c'è solo povertà, di qua e di là c'è solo povertà. Nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci sono più. Nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, gli dei non ci son più. Paesi senza tempo e con l'anima nel cielo, non portano la croce, non indossano il velo, si tuffano in valigie per disseminare tracce, ritornano a nascere con mille nuove facce. Di qua e di là c'è solo povertà, di qua e di là c'è solo povertà. Nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Terra bruciata, terra bruciata, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Terra bruciata, terra bruciata, terra bruciata, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia, nella Magna Grecia gli dei non ci son più. Terra bruciata come Sideos, terra avvelenata come Chegome, terra mutata.
Radiofonica.com.